Tony Simpson, Ryan Champion and Jack Bennion.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally, episode 9, season 11. We're nearly at the end. We've got one more episode to go. Stay with us. You've been here for the long haul so far. We appreciate your company. Don't do a Peter Odden Wingy with us where you just turn up last minute and then demand all kinds of things from us and you don't get it and we have to send you on your way. There you go. A slightly obscure football reference which Jack challenged me to get into the opening segment of this particular podcast. Anyway, speaking of Jack, on my right, I have Jack Bennion. Hello, Jack Bennion.
Hello, Tony Simpson.
And on my left, I have Ryan Champion.
Hello, Jack and Tony.
It's nice. You know what? It feels like we've not all been together, even though we were all together last week. It's been a long week. I don't know whether it's lack of sleep or whatever, but it seems like a while since we've all been together. I don't know why.
Exactly the same.
Do you? Okay, yeah. That's good. There's a couple of things, boys, but before we start. A Gary Boyd fact, because these days, to be honest with you. But a little bit of rally trivia for you, boys. I know you like your rally trivia. This is a kind of thing that probably we should have saved maybe for the Absolute Rally Pub quiz at the end of the year. Because after last year's, it's all uphill from there. A piece of rally trivia 20 years ago this week.
What's happening again then? You said never again. So there's a maybe in there.
Do you know what? I think we should dedicate the Absolute Rally podcast quiz to Henry Hope Frost and we should do it at the end of the year.
Oh, well, there you go. You've got to do it now.
Yeah, no pressure. Wow.
Well, he helped with last year's, didn't he? And
he did. Do you know what, mate? That is a really, really good point, and that's a really, really good idea. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we'll do something. We'll do something. In fact, you know what? I've just got a little bit of a tingle. I've still got some questions that Henry sent me that I didn't give you.
Oh, we could have a Henry Hope Frost trophy given to the person who gets the most number of questions that Henry suggested right. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, let's do something. That'd be really good. I like that idea. Well done, Jack Bennion.
Cheers.
Well
thanks. Done. Yeah, there you go. Every now and again.
Yeah, absolutely. A piece of rally of trivia. 20 years ago this week, Daniel Elliner and Sebastian Loeb competed together for the first time. They finished fourth overall in the Rally National, and it was held on the 28th and the 29th of March, 1998. There you go.
Hang on a minute. The first time they competed together?
20 years ago this week?
Yeah, that's right, you know, because I was going to say he started competing in 97, but that was with a different co-driver. So well done, Gary Boyd. You've one-upped me accidentally.
I was brave, that Jack, I'll be honest.
He's not even on the podcast and he's managed to one-up me. That's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Ryan, did you have a sharp intake of breath like me? I was thinking, God, Jack, this is brave. To take on Gary Boyd on a fact.
Yeah, I thought there was some piece of knowledge coming from somewhere there, but then he failed, didn't he, at the last moment?
He just basically tripped over himself.
All right, I'm going to try and defend myself here a little bit. Gary, in 1998, Sebastian Loeb competed in two cars. One was obviously the Citroën Saxo. What was the other one?
Can we answer this? That's an easy one. Sorry, Jack. That is so easy, it's untrue.
Oh, fair enough. I thought it would be quite difficult.
I reckon Ryan knows it, and I know it.
Right, well, you can answer it.
Shall I go or do you want to go?
You go. Well, I'm happy for you to go.
Okay, Toyota Corolla.
It's not the other car that I know of.
Oh, well, they definitely competed in a Corolla, and I'm sure it was on Corsica.
Was it in 98, though?
Oh. Ryan, am I off or is Jack off?
No, that was you were on about the V Rally car. That was 2000.
Not sure.
Yeah, Rye? I'm right.
What? There's a big claim. Rye, what do you think?
I think the Toyota was later. I definitely think the Toyota was later.
Okay. Right.
2000, it was. It was the V-Rally car.
Yeah, no, definitely, because he was in the Saxo kit car, wasn't he? Most of the time before that.
In 98, he was in the Saxo, and he competed in one of the cars as well. And I want Gary Boyd to tell me what the other car is.
There you go, Gary Boyd. Ryan and I have stumbled and trumbled and just basically avoided giving him the right answer.
Well, I think I have a feeling I know what it was, but let's it'll be interesting to see Gary's answer. The problem is he's going to have a bit of time to do some research on that now, isn't he?
No, you know what? Right, I think he'd be true to it. I don't think he'd do the research. I think if he knows, he'll answer. And if he doesn't, I think he's a gentleman and he would say, I didn't know the answer, but I found out and this is the answer. There you go. I give all our listeners credit like that, because I think we've got true proper good rally people that listen to us. I really do.
Gary Boyd definitely knows more about rallying than I do.
I think he knows more about rallying than pretty much you and me. Ryan, on the other hand, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it runs very, very close, because we've got a matching service as well. I don't know if you've noticed, somebody was tweeting us about maps for the RAC rally. Ryan Champion, straight in there, DM me, I'll sort them out. That's what we offer.
I didn't say I'd sort them out, but I'm sure I can put him on to a man who can.
Don't ruin it. Anyway, listen, boy, we've just been talking about Sebastian Loeb. He's obviously been doing his pre-event test, rather, ahead of Corsica. Seems very, very happy with it, Jack. You guys have wrote about it this week. Before I come back to you, Jack, I want to just point this to Ry first and foremost. His settings of the car, he says, are very similar to Chris's. Are we surprised by that?
Actually, I guess it's an interesting comment, isn't it, to think about. Am I surprised by it? I guess that would be the baseline, wouldn't it, for him driving the car. So he would have to drive it in a base spec. So the base setup is that of Chris's, and maybe he just found the car was quite comfortable at that. So, I think it probably comes from, you know, like you said, from the spec that the car was in, and then did it work for him? And if it did, well, he hasn't changed it far from that. So I guess it's not like he's probably created his own spec from zero. So I think he would start with what Chris had. So maybe that's where it came from.
Jack, I'll level with you. The reason why I went to Rye first is because I still don't know whether you get giddy and make a mess when we say Sebastian Loeb. So have you got a bit more, speaking of baselines, have you got a bit more of a baseline setting yourself now talking about Sebastian Loeb being back in WRC?
Yeah, I've adjusted my rear diff. I'm in much better shape now, to be honest.
There's an image that none of us wanted, Jack. Correct.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm not surprised that his settings are similar to me, because Chris was the pace setter on this event last year, so it seems like a logical thing to take Chris's setup and then work with it slightly. If you know it's one that works, then it seems like a logical decision from Sebastian.
Okay.
I think that was a long-winded version of saying the same, really.
Do you know what? Yeah. Right, there's a bit of a theme. I listened back, by the way, to our podcast last week for editing purposes, and I apologise. And you've just done exactly what I did last week, but you did it with far less words, where I basically repeated what Jack had said with a lot more words, and Ryan tripped me up on it straight away. Because that's how stuff goes down. I nearly said something else then. I could have said something else, to be honest with you, but still, I'm not going to. Anyway, we crack on. Where was it going to go with next with this? We spoke about it on the last couple of podcasts, obviously, after Rally Mexico, and of course, Mr. Sebastian Ogier's kind of setting the precedent now with people thinking about how they go into the power stage. Jack, it's now come up now, power stage rules under the spotlight.
Yeah, that's true. It looks like the change is going to go through. It's been kind of agreed upon. It needs to be rubber stamped by the World Motorsport Council, and I believe that's going to take place by an e-vote, which happens on April the 6th, thanks to David Evans for his story in MN this week. But the gist of the story is that anyone who sort of checks in late to a stage in order to gain an advantage will not be given any points for the power stage. So they'll kind of rule themselves out of gaining any extra points. So that should alleviate any of the problems. The only thing you can argue, I guess, is that, you know, if someone, you know, really does have a problem and checks into the power stage late, then they're going to be robbed of points. But at the end of the day, you know, rallying is rallying. If you've got a problem, then sometimes you have to deal with the consequences of it.
Right. Do you know what? I'm really, again, it's a typical thing that I say. I'm really conflicted on this, because I feel like somebody's found something and used it, and obviously it's opened it up to everybody now, and now the door's being closed on it.
Yeah, I mean, we know that loopholes have always been exploited in motorsport, and rallying's no different. But I guess the difference is here when you're playing with live TV. I mean, we need rallying to get all the coverage it can, and we've now got some form of live footage, and obviously the power stage is a big part of that. And when you're not seeing some of the key players on the power stage because of the tactics, then I guess they've got to put a stop to that. So I can understand it. I'm sure there'll still be loopholes going forwards. And as Jack just explained the rules there, I was trying to think of who's going to come up with some dubious force majeure reason as to why they booked in late. Because, you know, there was, a coach load of children were crossing the road and they couldn't get to the stage on time. So therefore they had to drop back on road time, and that should, etc.
That's a complex excuse that only a rally driver could come up with.
Do you know what, Jack? You've just beat me to it, because when we're doing this, I make little notes of things where I want to go next and things like that. And my next point was going to be Ryan Champion. So, what's the best excuse you've come up with in order to make sure that you've got that 2 minute gap or whatever it may be?
There is one that I do remember, but I don't think I'll talk about it openly on a podcast.
Boo! I can remember claiming to have a slow puncture once. That was a long time ago. To be fair, I was just a slow driver, so it doesn't make any difference anyway. But still, there you go. Couple of things. I don't really want to talk too much about Corsica, because I want to do kind of the runners and riders for Corsica next week. I think it's really interesting. I'm fascinated, and let's not do too much on it this week, boys. But I'm gonna mention it anyway, because you guys have put something in, Jack, and I've also been kind of keeping up to speed with it and kind of following bits and pieces. Is the Citroën C3 R5, and I am fascinated by this car. I really am. I think it's either going to be, I think it's almost like the world car again. It's either going to be completely outstanding, and especially in Corsica, because we always relate Citroën to be so strong in on those types of events, or it's potentially going to be a DS3 R5 again.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I think it's got a good chance of winning WRC2 this year, looking at the competition and the field. If they're going to commit Stefan to the rest of the year, then they've got a very good chance, because Skoda have got Pontus Tiedemann at the moment heading up their campaign, but I think Skoda is going to be a lot similar to last year, in the sense that Tiedemann's going to play the Mikkelsen role and be moved around sort of towards the second half of the year, so maybe won't be doing as many WRC2 events, or possibly might be in the Polo and do WRC2 events in that, we don't know. So depending on whether Tiedemann does the rest of the year, I think looking at the rest of the competition, as long as the car's good, then Stefan's got a good chance of doing well. So typically Citroën's have always gone well on tarmac, haven't they? So it'll be interesting to see its debut. It's had a lot of changes across its development. Sorry, Tony, you said you didn't want to talk too much about this, did you? But there's been a lot of things that have set back the development of the C3. Now it's out, it'll be interesting to see how it gets on at the weekend.
I might as well come to you, right? They can't run the risk of producing a lemon now, can they? You know, and not to put too fine a point on it, they can't. Because that, you know, we spoke about it before. Now WRC2 is works teams B, you know, it's the B teams, you know. I suppose, you know, we think about the All-Stars days with the Subarus. That's kind of how WRC2 is now, and you can't afford to put a lemon in there, because it is the shop window. You know, Skoda have used it, you know, time and time and time again now as their shop window to sell cars. And, you know, we joked last week about how many R5s, of course, we're on Azores, which we're going to talk about in a second, but, you know, that's what they need. They need that kind of domination in order to sell those cars, don't they? And I'm guessing the way the budgets are at the moment, you know, I'm guessing they do need to sell cars now, because that's going to be a way of funding the team.
Yes, good point you make. We know that their budget isn't as big for the WRC team as certainly as what it has been in the past, and not as big as some of their rivals. The R5 car is all about a customer category. It's all about selling customer cars, and the reason they do that is to make money. So you're quite right, they'll be very, very keen for the car to be competitive against the Skoda, against the Ford, and the Hyundai, obviously, that's emerging now and becoming more and more popular. It's really important that it works. And I mean, the DS3 R5 wasn't slow when it worked. You know, if we remember, Keith Cronin took some fantastic results in it. Craig Breen in the 208 that was mechanically virtually identical. It was a good car, and still is a good car when it works. It just seemed to chuck up more problems than some of the other R5 cars. But I'm sure they'll put an awful lot of development into the new R5 car. And like you said, I'm sure they're very, very keen to make sure it works and to get some of that customer business.
Jack, I think that You nailed it, and we keep on. I've said it so many times in many different ways, and I know Wright took the mick out of me last week because you've mentioned it a couple of times that this WRC2 category now for R5, you know, it is a place where you've got work teams, and this is where they, you know, you need to have a working car there. You know, if you want to be serious and you want drivers to look at you, you need to have a working car there. And of course, you know, Hyundai have got it. You know, they're still very early on when you think about it compared to M Sport and of course Skoda Motorsport. But you know, Citroen are the odd one out at the moment, and they need to go there and they need to hit the ground running. Just for morale of the squad, really.
Yeah, definitely. It's a difficult championship to be in. And the thing is, when you've got a lot of different manufacturers building cars to a pretty sort of well-policed format, you know, the reliability does become an issue because the number of parts you can use that are different and the amount of development you can do is sort of limited in terms of the outcome of the performance of the car. So, you know, obviously different manufacturers are going to develop, you know, different quality of cars, but the reliability does become, you know, really important in that situation. So that's one factor they'll have to build in. But, you know, they're also going up against a Skoda squad and the Fords and stuff as well that have got data from all these events from before with their car specific to set up in different conditions as well as the roads themselves. So, you know, it's not an easy thing just because they're the newest R5. You know, people get a little bit carried away, I think, sometimes with people bringing out new cars, and you know, because it's the newest, it has to be the best. They're going up against some work teams with a lot of budget, a lot of experience, a lot of testing on these different rallies. So, you know, it's not going to be easy for Citroën by any stretch of the imagination, but as you quite rightly pointed out, as a, you know, customer-based program, it's very important that the car is A, reliable, and B, quick.
There you go. So, well, as I say, folks, we'll talk more about Corsica next week. We previewed it last week. We were hoping to have Master Ingram on with us this week. He dropped us for the BBC. What can I say? So he was meant to be with us. He's not going to be with us, but we are going to have another guest. This is going to be dead weird, Ryan Champion. We've got a mini Jack Benyon joining us after the break. We're going to have a break shortly, but we've got a mini Jack Benyon going to be joining us. Can you believe it?
Does he look like Jack Benyon as well?
He's taller than me. If you call him a mini Jack Benyon, he's taller than me.
When I say mini, I don't mean in the sense of height. I mean, I just mean kind of, you know, maybe your hero spec compared to him. Maybe he sees you as a, you know, a bit of a hero, Jack.
Maybe you should ask him.
Maybe we will. Maybe we'll come to that in a second. But before we bring him in, we'll do our bits and pieces. Ryan Champion, did you keep your finger on the pulse of Azores and what was going on?
Yeah, I think I did, really. It's funny. It's great to see Alexei Lukyanov get to the end of a rally and win one, because he's a lovable character, isn't he, in rallying? He drives with his heart on his sleeve. He's always flat out. He's always spectacular. He's got a smile on his face. I just think he's great to see in rallying. We see so many professional teams now and people there to do a job, whereas he always just strikes me as somebody that goes out to drive as fast as he can all weekend. And great to see people like that getting a result.
Nice if you can afford it. If you can afford to roll the dice like that. But no, I completely agree with you, by the way.
He seems on a budget as well, doesn't he? I don't think he's got masses of money behind him. I don't know. Jack will know a bit better. But, you know, you often seem relatively unsponsored compared to some of his competitors. Yeah, great to see.
Yeah, there you go. Jack, your thoughts from Azores. Obviously, we're going to have your man from Autosport going to be joining us after the break shortly, who was there, who was covering the event. Did you keep an eye on it, Jack?
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan's right. You know, Lukyanov's not one of the best backed drivers. I wouldn't say he was short of money in that sense, but you know, he's not one of the best R5 sort of funded drivers. But, you know, I think the big thing for him is we've got to remember, you know, in June last year, he had a huge accident and in a testing crash in Russia and was in hospital for over a month. He'd broken his left foot, his knee, a fractured pelvis, broken back, bruised lungs. He went through all sorts of surgery, and you know, within a few months after that, he was back competing, and that was kind of a big story in the RC last year about how quickly Alexei came back from all those things. And one of the events that he did, you know, he did do a few events at the start of the year where he was sort of before the injury, and the Azores was one of them, and he crashed out of the lead. So one of the things he did this weekend was try and scale back, which is something that we've talked about on the podcast before, and something, you know, I've definitely called for, and I'm sure other people have, just to get Alexei, just to rein it in a little bit. Just, you know, we know you're fast, you know, you've proved it, but just bring it back a little bit and get yourself to the end of some events. And that's something that he identified that he needed to do at the start of the season and did before this event. So yeah, very good performance from him, and lots of other sterling performances through the field, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, it was, you know, as I say, we were hoping to have Chris Ingram on, to be honest with you. I was surprised, right? Hand on heart, I was surprised. I thought Chris would go well because he's done the event quite a few times. He's got sets of notes, but that's not to take anything away from the performance.
No, not at all, because he looked very at home. That's the great thing, is it just looked like he'd been driving an R5 car in competition for a long time, and he was right at home, setting, you know, competitive times with well-established drivers in ERC. And yeah, like you say, he's been and done it before, but never in an R5 car. So it's a great for him. Great confidence boost for the rest of the year now for him, because he's got a solid result under his belt, set some good times as well, and he knows he can perform now. So, you know, for his confidence, it's the best way he could start, and hopefully he can push on from here.
There you go. As I say, folks, we are going to do a little bit more after the break with regards to Rally Azores with the man from Autosport. But, boys, we've got to that point, believe it or not, already, because we're running a tight ship this week, for any other business. Can you believe it?
Yeah, mate, I can believe it.
Okay, there you go. Ryan Champion, I think it's important that you go first.
Is it? Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, no problem.
A little bit of any other business hot off the press pre-Corsica is Thierry Neuville has ended up off the road and down a hillside in a river, but driver and co-driver both here, but the car was a little bit secondhand. Who else was going to go with that one? It's a big start.
No one. That's new. That is quite literally breaking news.
I thought the big sigh was somebody else was going to go with that one, but it was ended up a little bit off the road. Car had quite heavy frontal damage, but anyway, the cockpit's intact. Driver and co-driver okay, and I'm sure Thierry will still go very well on the rally. So that was pretty recent news, that one. My other one was just picking up on a story that Motorsport News are running this week, and it was interesting that they're not allowing right-hand drive R5 cars in the Irish Tarmac Championship. And for all the left-hand drive markets out there, for everybody listening, they'll think, well, why does it matter? But Ireland's had a long history of liking right-hand drive rally cars. In the UK, a lot of drivers have got used to left-hand drive, but particularly in Ireland, they do still like right-hand drive cars. And to me, you know, we want people to compete. We want as many cars out there. So it would be great if things like that could really be ironed out. And you can choose whether you want left-hand drive or right-hand drive, because there's no performance advantage. Get it sorted.
Right. Is this due to the fact, because I don't know whether I'm actually allowed to say this or not. Okay. Where do we go with this? Right. Obviously, it's not because nobody's homologating right-hand drive.
That's right.
R5 cars.
Yeah.
And that's the issue. So if somebody was actually going to homologate one, if one of the manufacturers homologated right-hand drive, then it wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, but there's costs associated with that as well. So, you're increasing your costs by homologating a right-hand drive car as well. But, I think it'd be nice to see that allowed, or nice to see it as an extension on the homologation papers. Pro Drive have done it in the past with the Subarus in the early days. Again, it was a similar thing. I think it was Austin McHale turned up to Rally GB one year with a right-hand drive Corolla and was refused to start for a similar thing. And it's been around in the sport for a long time, but like I said, we want to encourage as many people as we can. So I think it's the sort of thing that hopefully can be solved in the future.
I do know that there is a manufacturer looking at homologating an R5 in right-hand drive.
There's more than one manufacturer looking at homologating right-hand drive R5 cars.
Okay. There you go. I don't know whether we're allowed to say them or not.
The one you're thinking of was mentioned in a statement from the Irish Tarmac Championship, which was put out after the West Cork Rally, confirming that manufacturer was building a right-hand drive car. So
okay, well, you can say it then.
Proton.
Yes.
Are one of the people who are considering doing it. M Sport have also said from pretty much from when the R5 first came out that if there was enough of a customer base, they would consider homologating a right-hand drive car as well. And I'm sure the other manufacturers would follow suit if there was enough business there. I think M Sport and Proton are your most logical ones, really, aren't they, considering they're the ones closest to the Irish customer base. So, yeah, now I can side right because you did take my own other business.
Now, there you go. So, have you not got any other business?
No, I can have a quick one.
Cool. Go on.
Do we have many listeners in France?
It's a very interesting question, Jack Benyon, and I can confirm to you we have none.
Okay. Well, that angle of the end of the business isn't going to work then. the championship that Ryan knows very well, the British Cross Country Championship, is not going to run in the UK in 2018, which is sad news for the competitors who are in that. And the British Cross Country Championship is basically a championship where you can take sort of space framed different machinery. Lots of people have put sort of Evo engine type machines in there with quite a bit of brake horsepower and then gone and rallied them on cross road events. So stages used on Rally GB, sections of them have been used in the Cross Country Championship, and you basically get a set amount of runs on a stage. And there's some pretty cool machinery that make some pretty cool noises that are not going to be able to compete in the UK this year, which is quite sad. And the reason I asked about France was quite a few of them are considering going to do some cross-country rallying in France as well, which is quite big on the continent. There's quite a few sort of hill rallies and cross-country events that are big in Europe and attract some pretty cool cars. And there's one that I will share through my Twitter page later on, which I found earlier, which is, let me get this right, it's a T16 body shell type with all the spoilers and everything like a T16, but it's got a Mazda Le Mans rotary engine in it, and it's one of the most mental and fantastic sounding machines I've ever heard.
It was at the Goodwood Festival of Speed last year, and it's just awesome.
Oh, unbelievable. But yeah, right, you'll be able to tell us a little bit more about the cars, I guess. You've driven quite a few of them, so.
yeah, well, like you said, I mean, the technical regulations are quite free, and you start off with a space frame and you can build what you want around that. So the interesting thing is with the off-road championship is you can see everything from V8 through to six-cylinder BMW engines, Evo motors, as you said, or rotary. So there is some really exciting stuff out there, and they use a lot of forestry sections, as you've said, the likes of Sweet Lamb and Walter's Arena and many of the other Welsh stages, Radnor. So sad to see that they're struggling as well, because as we've talked about, you know, rally entries are down. So it is across motorsport, but I guess one thing that should be applauded that I think will really help rally entries going forward, and that's rally two-wheel drive that we saw on Rally North Wales last weekend, where there's a separate rally for two-wheel drive cars running first on the road once again. And you know, let's hope that we see a lot of the historic cars back in the forests again, because they've been hiding away with the issues that we've had in the UK with road order. So let's see more events running two wheel drive up front, and let's see more of those lovely two wheel drive cars back out in the woods.
And we need another 45 minutes to talk about rally two wheel drive, I think.
I think we would. I think we would. And if you were a marshal on that event,
yeah,
I'd doff my cap.
So do I. Fair play. They were the heroes of that event, not the drivers or the crews or the cars. It was the volunteers who stayed out much longer than they probably should have had to on a normal rally.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. We'll do more on rally two wheel drive. I'm really conflicted on it, to be honest. But hey, there you go. So we come to my any other business now. I've got two pieces of any other business, and one of them is related actually to what you've just mentioned. We had a little bit of back and forth. You may remember, I think, I don't know whether you got involved, Jack, but definitely Ryan did. A couple of weeks ago now, talking about, you know, cars not being homologated and, you know, not building stuff anymore and things like that.
I did read those. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Mike Shore over in the States, you know, I had a conversation with him. I know Mike listens as well, and he does a podcast too. And I think Rye, you waded in as well. It was with regards to the fact of, you know, people, you know, manufacturers perhaps not building cars anymore because of litigation and stuff like that. And I was very keen to point out, I don't believe that was the case, but I do firmly believe you can build whatever rally car you want. And I think you backed me up on that. I think, right, I think you kind of went with that, and you know, we went outside homologation. Now, on Rally North Wales at the weekend. Jack, you guys have wrote a bit of a piece about it. I actually had a look at the car yesterday. John Goff, who of course I've got a long association with the driver and his cars, and he's run cars for me in the past and stuff like that, and built a Toyota Corolla, a rally first car, 2 litre, and he's built it for just under $6,000. And it's a modern shape. I think it's an 05, 06 plated car. He's built it, you know, all in, 10 days labour. And, you know, it's cost him just shy of $6,000. So, you know, this can still happen. And, you know, I don't know why, you know, I don't know why people get sucked into the fact that you've got to spend a shed load of money on buying a car just to go rallying. You don't. You can still build stuff.
Mentality, isn't it, Tony? It's a mentality. It's like one of the things I was trying to get across in the rally special that we did, you know, a little while ago. Not to, you know, steal you any other business away from you, but you know, it can, like you said, it can be done. People just need to not defeat themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we all get sucked in. You know, it is me. You got rid of the perennial ST and bought an R2. Jesus, that's been an expensive few weeks for me quite recently. But still, that's another conversation for a different day. But if you just want to go rallying, I know Brian, you were quite passionate about this as well last week. You know, of making it more affordable. I think building a car, you know, when you think about, you know, a dad and lad situation or a dad and daughter, of course, we had Molly on last week, we talked about this type of stuff, you know, can go out legitimately and build a car between them. You know, it can take a year or whatever it can take, you know, you just kind of potter in the garage and build a very safe, very, very good car for sub $6,000. That's very cheap motorsport, isn't it, right?
Yeah, it is. And like you said, it can be done. It's all relevant. It's as soon as you want to get competitive, then that's generally when it gets expensive. But it still can be done. It still can be done affordably. Like I said, I'm all for making it as easy as possible. You know, like we said, and again, that was confirmed on Twitter as well, that if you look at CAMS, what they do in Australia, they extend the life of seat belts, and they don't have a regulation on seats. And the interesting thing is, why do we have a date regulation on seats in rallying, and yet they don't in circuit racing? So there's a lot of things out there that you know, I would like to see made a little bit more simple for people to understand. But nonetheless, you can compete at sensible cost.
There you go. And I've got one last piece of any other business, and Jack, I'll bring you in for this one because it's David Evans' piece, and it's with regards to the Richard Burns Foundation.
Yep.
And yeah, you know, it's something which I think we've probably all been touched by or all been involved with at different times over the years and things like that. You know, it's raised £1 million, which is an amazing amount of money for anybody. But you know, it's naturally now getting to the point where they're actually closing the doors on it. And, you know, just looking back at what they've done and what they've achieved, you know, even quite recently, you look at what they've done, obviously with adapted cars and things like that, adapted rally cars, you know, that's probably the most recent thing that I can remember. But, you know, an amazing thing. And, you know, it's just something I just wanted to mention, really.
Yeah, David Evans has written a brilliant piece about it this week in MN, which I encourage you to go and pick up, which provides a lot more information. You know, I came along at a time where, you know, I was watching Richard growing up. So he was quite important for me in terms of a person to get into rallying. Amazingly, really weird story. I ended up playing football with Richard Burns at Alton Park while watching British touring cars in the sort of late 90s, which is an absolute bizarre state of affairs, to be honest. But yeah, read David Evans' column this week. It'll do a far better job of explaining the whole situation there, and will sort of sum up Richard's memory far better than I could. So yeah, go and have a read of that.
I think so. Right. I think we, you know, I know the Pirelli got involved with the rally. The Pirelli rally itself got involved with Richard Burns Foundation. And, you know, we got T-shirts and things like that over the years. And, you know, I think I've still got one somewhere, actually. But obviously it's something you would have been involved with or been touched by at some point over the last 10 or 15 years as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've done a great job at, obviously making the most of Richard's situation and publicising, you know, some great causes and raising money to go along with it as well. And they, again, we mentioned Goodwood Festival of Speed a little bit earlier on. Richard Burns Foundation have been one of the official charities of Goodwood every year, and they raise good money for great causes such as this.
there you go, folks. There you go, folks. Check it out. As I say, it is it's a very interesting read. And yeah, there you go. There you go. Boys, as I say, we've got to the end of this section. We are going to go over now to one of Jack's colleagues at Autosport. Right, are you back with us for our final episode of this particular particular season? We've got one more to go.
I am indeed. Yep, I'll be here next week.
There you go. It's very, very exciting. Last episode of this particular season. Folks, yeah, so we'll all be back at the same time, same place in the podcast hall next week. But in the meantime, stay with us. We'll go to a little break, and then we'll be back with Jack's colleague from Autosport, who's going to tell us all about Rally Azores.
You're listening to Absolute Rally. Get all the latest updates by following us on Twitter at @Absolute_Rally.
Welcome back to the second part of Absolute Rally. Ryan Champion has gone on his way now. He's gone to drive peasants off his land or drive a supercar one-handed or whatever. You know what Ryan Champion does? He could be on a frozen... He's not in a frozen lake. I know he was sat in his loft when he was talking to us before. Let's pull away the smoke and mirrors. It wasn't that as impressive as when he spoke to his Jack one-handed on a frozen lake, was it?
No. He's got a nice loft, though, in fairness.
He has got a nice loft, it has to be said, but it's Ryan Champion. What would you expect?
Yeah, I'm surprised he's not off saving the world somewhere or, you know, obtaining some nuclear launch codes or, you know, whatever he does in his spare time, being a secret agent man that he is.
He's gone away to do something, but while he's gone away to do something, of course, we wanted to get your man with his finger on the pulse.
I wondered where you're going with that, Tony.
Well, he might be your man. Listen, we're open minded, Jack. We're not going to judge. You know, whatever goes, go. Hang on a minute. I'm going to do a proper introduction and then I'm going to ask Matt a very, very important question. Matt Q from Autosport, who is covering Rally Azores. Welcome to Absolute Rally for the first time.
Thanks very much for having me on. It's good to be on.
It's lovely. Now, are you awake yet?
Yeah, sort of.
Good. Good. Folks, again, we always drop people in it. We just woke him up basically to
it's
do this.
So. It's the jet lag of the hour time difference at the Azores. Yeah.
It's huge, yeah. Isn't it? It's huge. You've got to be dead careful. Matt, do you wear hair product?
Yeah, VO5 Matt Clay.
Okay. I hope you're not looking for any kind of endorsement from somebody listening to this podcast. That's God, that's hoping, isn't it? Okay. Is that the same product as you, Jack Banyan?
No, I don't use any product in my hair.
Rubbish.
I call bullshit, and I'm allowed to say that word on my podcast, as you keep on saying, Jack. It's my train set.
It is.
We all know that there's product in there, Jack.
Sometimes I use hairspray, but not very often.
I'm thinking something about Mary. I'm going to leave it there.
Yeah, move on.
I'm going to leave it there. Listen, Jack, of course, Matt is your colleague from Autosport. We've spoke a little bit about Rally Azores, but of course, Matt, you were there. Was this your first experience of going on an ERC round?
Yeah, absolutely. Before, it's definitely been, it's been events based in the UK, mainly circuit rally, so it's a big step up.
Okay. Now, Jack was going to give you loads of difficult questions, which he will do in a second. From an experience point of view, and this is quite nice because you were there, obviously, as a journalist, but you were also there, I'm guessing, as a rally fan.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say, Matt? What was the general, have you been to any WRC rounds and things like that?
No, not that I can remember. I mean, I've been taken round to Wales GB before, but yeah, that's long before my memory.
So this is quite new and fresh. Having done some of the MN circuit rounds, as you've just said, what was it like for you to kind of arrive at an event and be part of something where you've got that press pass and being able to wander around and talk to who you wanted to?
It was fantastic. The scale was quite overwhelming when I got there. But with there's certain drivers and certain teams, and without wanting to blow smoke, but having Jack Benyon as sort of an icebreaker to talk about his hair was a great way in. And then from there, by the end of it, I think you're chatting to drivers so regularly that they get to, you know, you get to sort of form your own quick relationship over the weekend. And then from there, sort of you can go hunting for news and the real stories.
So, Matt, the landscape of Azores is something pretty special, isn't it? For someone who, you know, I'd say the majority of your kind of career and your upbringing, you were at a circuit, so you kind of travel to the circuit, you're at the circuit all day, and then you go home afterwards. Whereas the fantastic thing that rallying offers is, you know, you get to go out into the scenery, you get to explore some of the forests and some of the landscapes. we've talked about a lot about Azores in the build up to this podcast and in the past as well about how scenic the pictures look and things like that. Just give us a bit of a flavour about what that's like in person, because it's one thing looking at a picture of volcanoes and things like that, but what was it like to actually see, you know, an R5 car flying through the middle of a volcano?
Yeah, as you say, sort of if your local circuits are Rockingham and Silverstone, then I think with a bit of greenery, it goes down well. The volcano, like the stunning shots you usually see with the lake in the background, I didn't get to see that. We did go up to the mountain, but we were in a cloud, so it's about 3 foot of visibility. Having said that, on the opening day, we were at the second stage where the cars are basically coming over a jump out of the woods and then sort of, 400 metres round the outside of the lake, kicking up dirt and then shooting off over a hill. And then on the second day, we were just at the foot of one of these jumps over a stone wall. And you've got mountains in the background, you've got wooded areas. And it's sort of like, without wanting to play it down, it's sort of, you could be in Scotland, you could be in the Yorkshire Dales. It's sort of like, almost like a patchwork quilt of different iconic landscapes. It's totally in love with the island.
Brilliant. And then in terms of the event, I mean, Alexi was the man who kind of ran away with it in the end, it kind of looked like on the outside. But is there any sort of key performances you can pick out in the top 10 of people who were kind of particularly impressive over the course of the weekend?
I'm not sure if you've spoken about it before. We have together, but I was particularly impressed by Freddie Arlen. He went there and he said sort of, hands down, this is my first, you know, I'm here for the full season now with ERC. It was D-Mac's first time there. And he went totally conservative, and he was happy to admit that he was just following the tracks made by those who had already been on the stage and sticking to those and sort of, you know, not putting an inch wrong. As much as it's probably Chris Ingram that's grabbed the headlines, I thought he cut it really fine with some oversteer. You know, he clipped a tree, took the bumper off. He could have quite easily sort of taken himself out of that rally. The fact he got fourth and the class win is fantastic. I thought Arlen just had a really, really mature weekend.
Yeah, it's interesting what you picked out there with the D-Mac. You know, we've talked a lot about D-Mac on Absolute Rally, and I think some of their achievements were absolutely spectacular. Obviously, Rally GB last year has got to be a pretty major one. But they don't bring anywhere near the budget that the kind of Pirellis and the Michelins of this world bring. And they've been going, to, you know, Michelin and Pirelli have been going to that event for many years now. And Chris himself has been for the last four. Frederick turned up for the first time there with no notes or anything to go off and on a tyre that, you know, wasn't as good as the Pirelli or the Michelin. Then you kind of say so. Would you say that's kind of one of the key reasons why he was impressive over the weekend?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. He wasn't familiar with the roads at all. Obviously, I think this was Ingram's fifth time on the stages. He was still using his R2 notes, which caused him a bit of a headache, sort of when he realised how much faster he was going. But yeah, Arlen, it was a blank canvas for him, and he came out of it really strongly, I thought.
Going back to Alexi, we mentioned on a podcast just a little bit earlier on with Ryan and Tony that Alexi had, appeared to have some sort of change in his driving style. Can you tell us a little bit about how that sort of played out across the weekend and what you saw from him in terms of his driving style and the things that he talked about changing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's fair to say he's drawn a bit of criticism sometimes on this podcast for his sort of win or bust, you know, 10-10 style, sometimes sort of 11-10, and getting it wrong. But he was quite open, and he said that over the off season he sort of worked to scale that back so he can convert more of his leads rather than crashing out like he did last year out the lead of Azores. Having said that, and he was quite funny about this, it all boiled over on the final stage. So about 200 metres before the finish line, he had a half spin and then basically just ended up firing a load of donuts in front of the crowds and cut 30 seconds out of his lead before continuing. And he was, all bored over all this exuberance. But I think on stage he was somewhere between sort of like a Bruno Magalhães and Chris Ingram in terms of flair and style. And he was comfortably, I think there was only two stages where he was outside the top 10. And one of those was when he was donuting. So yeah, I thought impressive drive, and if he can continue that for the rest of the season, then yeah, it's quite impressive.
Doing his best job, and it's impressive, Tony.
I know. Do you know what? I was just thinking that. Okay, you know what Rye was just saying before at the first part of the podcast about, you know, expressing himself and being happy and stuff like that. And then when I heard about the donuts, then I was thinking, oh, how cool is that? And then the first thing I thought, who's the last person who I could possibly remember doing donuts at that kind of level and Panizzi underneath. Yeah, so great minds think alike, Jack Benny. If we're going with this, do you know what, guys? I just wanted to. It's great just listening every now and again. To be honest with you, as opposed to speaking. But Frederick, do you know what, Matt? It's a really, really good point. I've not really thought about it. You know, obviously Frederick's first time there and everything else, and obviously the tyre situation. Of course, you know, we've been very aware of, you know, just how well the D-Max have worked, you know, on the colder, wetter events. But of course, this was a very, very dry event, wasn't it, Matt? It was, you know, very dry, very abrasive, the surface out there. So, you know, again, tyre management, I'm guessing, must have been a big part of Frederick's strategy. Did he talk much about that?
Hang on, I've got some quotes in front of me that I can scroll down and find, which isn't very slick. But I'll fill the time by saying that the Azores Islands have been made out of a volcano. So the entire landscape is this really, really solid sort of like magma type rock. And it was just shredding the tyres. I mean, Mora had punches. I think it was stone damage that sort of wrecked Bruno Magalhães's diff, and that had to be changed. And Ingram had a puncher as well. So it was a really tough surface to drive on. And if I can find the quotes.
You talk amongst yourselves as we do it. It's fine. It's not a problem. Listen, while you're looking for those quotes, Jack, you know, obviously we've mentioned Chris a couple of times now. He was going to be on. You know, he definitely, I said it before, looked very, very comfortable and everything else. I'm not entirely sure whether Chris and whether you've heard too much about that. I did really want to ask him about this. Obviously, he's using the prize fund from winning the under-27s last year. Of course, in the Opel Adam. I'm not entirely sure whether that entire prize season through the season is that. Have you heard any more about working towards? I've seen a few things quoted that he's also trying to take in a couple of rounds of BRC, which would be Manx, Ypres, and GB as well. So I don't quite know how they're stretching that budget out with TalkSport, but I know he's got the tie up with 11 Degrees. Is he looking at completing the season, Jack? Have you heard anything?
He's trying to do as many events as he can, and he wants to do the whole season. The problem is, you know, the €100,000 prize from Eurosport was, you know, yeah, I'm not going to go too PR about it, but there's not many places you can earn €100,000 towards your program. And there's no doubt in my mind that Chris would be struggling to drive an R5 car this year without that prize. But also, that prize isn't enough to cover a whole ERC season, unfortunately, in terms of costs. So Chris is going to have to, you know, add to that with the money that he's already earned. But he's planning to do the Canaries, as far as you know. The quotes from this week's story in MN that David Evans has written sort of imply that. And we know there is a tarmac car, isn't there, back in the UK, so sounds like he should be okay to do the Canaries, and that'll be an interesting one for him, because last year I went to that one and did cover Chris in the under-27s there when he was in the Opel, and tyres was a big thing there. The surface also quite abrasive on that island as well, even though that's tarmac, so it'll be interesting to see how he goes there, and also a bit of a new challenge in terms of him being on tarmac again. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes there. In terms of the whole season, I think, you know, at this point, Tony, it's probably quite difficult for even Chris to say exactly what he'd be doing in terms of budget and stuff, but I know he's planning to try and do the whole ERC season, and that's the aim, to try and win the under-28 category.
Well, I think even Frederick's picking and choosing it. I don't know whether Matt, did you get anything?
Frederick's absolutely.
Go on, sorry.
No, it's okay. Frederick's absolutely not planning to do the whole year. There's definitely two or three events he'll miss. Cyprus, for example, Greece, those kind of events he'll miss, but he plans to come back and do the full season the year after.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Matt. You were looking through some bits and pieces there, weren't you? As Jack and I were chuntering away with regards to Chris Ingram, you've got some quotes there from Frederick.
Yeah. So he was just saying sort of D-Max never been here before, and so, you know, that left him completely blank of data, and so it was only really from the recce that they were. I mean, I think there were nine different compounds to choose from, and so it was sort of just a balancing act between getting it on the. On the right side, because those that are on softer tyres, yeah, were shredding. I think, for example, Laurent Pellier, I think he crashed out on the opening day, and so under Rally 2 rules, he couldn't rejoin until day 3. And so he probably only had 110 miles of running and had two punches in that time, so out of his 18 tyres. So that was sort of the level of abrasiveness we're talking about with the surface. So the fight for sort of DMACC and Arlen to get through that, whether it's more luck than judgment, I'm not really sure, but it seemed sort of that they got the call just about right.
Good man, good man. Just very quickly, Matt, before we let you go, can we do, I don't know whether you've got the info there and whether you can recall it, but just it'd be nice to do a bit of a roundup, I suppose, of some of the two-wheel drive guys as well. I know Katie was out there, wasn't she, for instance, in the Santa Locker?
Yeah, so speaking to Katie, and over, she's had a busy winter. She's been in a fitness camp, which has been used by the likes of OJ and Esteban Ocon, among others, and she was saying sort of, you know, on the journeys home from that, she was having to pull over at the roadside to sort of, I'll be polite and say, gather herself after some intense days at training. And yeah, she's also been ice driving on some of the lakes. She's been doing some instructing, and that was deliberately because she feels gravel rallies a bit of a tough one for her. She crashed out of Azores last year, I think, only on the second stage. So she was just delighted to sort of get this one under her belt and over and done with. I mean, she was charmed by the island, but I don't think by the rally itself. Ericsson, he hit a concrete post while having just sort of topped the times on stage five, and he rolled the Opel twice and was out. And then, it was Diogo Gogo that sort of, if you forgive the pronunciation, that was sort of, it was quite a heartwarming result.
Matt, you're on safe ground pronunciations on this podcast. Don't worry, my friend. Trust me, that was probably as close to the Morale I'll ever get it.
Fantastic. I did try to discreetly mumble it to see if I could get away with it, but it looks like we're okay.
But a man after my own heart.
His was quite a heartwarming result, really. What it means for him long term will be interesting to see, because he hasn't got the budget to do more rounds at the minute. So sort of getting maximum returns and winning is the best he can hope for if he wants to reappear. And albeit Ericsson crashed out, but he still had to beat Martin Sex in the other Opel. So yeah, I thought that was a strong performance in the R2 class.
There you go.
Tony, can I ask one more question before we wrap up?
Of course you can. One last question.
I think it'd be interesting to know, the championship that Chris Ingram is trying to win this year is the under 28 category, which is for drivers who are under 28, obviously, because that's what the name of the category is, for R5 cars.
No.
And last year's winner was Marianne Griebel, who's a German driver who's very quick and also a policeman, which I think is quite amusing. I don't really know why, but you know, I think you don't really think about these drivers as having sort of regular day jobs, do you? I can't imagine Griebel pulling me over on the motorway, for example, for speeding. That would be quite ironic, wouldn't it? But yeah, he won the under 28 championship last year and is switching to a Peugeot this year, and he took our man Matt Q out for a little ride on the first stage on Thursday. So Matt, not many people on this podcast or listening to this podcast probably will have been out in an R5 before. So give us a little bit of a flavour of what that was like and what Marianne was like in the car as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic. He's so composed. I mean, it was loud, and I was just sort of using an off-the-shelf helmet, so I wasn't plugged in sort of to the comms. But he was so relaxed, sort of giving it one-handed and donating around the streets.
Does that mean he couldn't hear you squealing?
I tried to sort of like clap quite visibly so he could see that I was loving it and for him to go faster. No, it was brutal off the line, really quick acceleration. It was a bit difficult for me because I'm quite tall, I'm 6'4", so it was kind of my helmet and my backside basically wedging me in. I wasn't really sat in the seat, it was just sort of two kind of sort of points where I was just rubbing against the roof and the seat. So it was quite brutal, but I absolutely love it. He was so composed. From the passenger seat, it was quite hard to sort of think about what we were doing, trying to process it. So let alone to be sort of ahead of that, to be able to, you know, really take the maximum out of the machine. God knows what it'd been like in the Fabia, because obviously Marianne had a pretty poor rally between himself and the Peugeot. But I absolutely loved it. On the cobbled streets as well, there was no grip, so it was sliding like crazy, and all the while just flashes from camera phones as there were thousands and thousands of fans on the streets. It was really quite special.
Good man. Listen, Matt, it's been great having you on. Will you come back and talk to us again soon about rallying?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. It's been great to be on.
That's assuming I'll let him do any more, Tony.
Of course it is. If Jack Bennion lets you do any more, we'll bring you back.
Who's your favourite autosport and MN journalist, Matt?
Sorry, the line went a bit bad then.
Of course it did.
And on that note, listen, Matthew, thanks for joining us. Jack, you'll be back with the same time, same place next week.
Of course.
Folks, we're back after this break with our next section on coaching with Trevor Agnew.
You're listening to Absolute Rally. Get all the latest updates by following us on Twitter at @Absolute_Rally.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally. You may have noticed last week that we had an MIA. We had a missing in action. Trevor Agnew didn't join us, but we had... I nearly said one of his experiments. That sounds really, really wrong, doesn't it? I said Molly Taylor crossed with us last week, Trev, who a patient. No, it's not. A client. I don't know. What's the correct term, Trev?
I call her a coachee. So someone who I coach would be a coachee, yeah.
Okay. I see. I do that with my son. I go coachee, coachee, co.
Oh, there you go. It's different.
There you go. Anyway, we digress. Trev, we obviously we've been doing going through the coaching, and we thought Molly would be it'd be really good to get Molly right in the middle, and sure enough, Molly never ever lets you down. And folks, I apologise kind of last week for having a really, really extra long podcast, but trust me, the 40 minutes with Molly was still condensed down from about an hour and a half because Molly's great and she can just talk, and I could do about three podcasts with Molly. She's just ace. But anyway, Trev, we've done Why Do You Rally? What's your long team? What you want to achieve long term, limiting beliefs, where are you now? We're up to number five, which is knowledge, skills and attitude. And kind of way I want to do it, I want to kind of do kind of a few minutes on each one, maybe 5 minutes on each one. So knowledge is very an open-ended one. My gut feeling when I first read that was, is that knowledge of the sport? Is that knowledge of yourself? Just expand a little bit on the knowledge.
Yeah, well, what else would you think about if I fired back to you just quickly?
What else would I think about? Knowledge, well, genuinely, it would be, you know, the first thing is it, do I know what I'm getting myself into? Is it, you know, is it knowledge of the sport? You know what you're trying to do? And then if you think a little bit deeper, you know, am I geared for this? You know, is this really what I want to do?
Yeah. Okay. When we set up a sports management company way back in 2000, one of the things that I wanted to do was put together a blueprint of what the perfect rally driver would look like and perfect co-driver, of course. So the best people to talk to about that were the people who would eventually hopefully employ the guys who were going through our program. So that was Malcolm Wilson, that was David Richards, David Lapworth. It was also Corrado Provera, Jean-Pierre Nicolas, those type of people. So you go along to them and say, okay, what does the perfect rally driver look like? And they'll give you a description of it. So the knowledge of where you're heading, what you need to be able to do, and what those attributes, what the behaviour's like, what the personality's like, and more importantly, the skills, the attitude, and what else that goes with it. So from the knowledge of where you need to be as regards to the goals for you personally and your journey and what you need to learn along the way, because that's what we're talking about with knowledge. So wherever you are at the minute, what extra knowledge do you need to become the perfect rally driver? That's really the areas that we'd focus on with that one.
Okay, and I'm guessing, you know, the first things that scream out are, you know, obviously ability. I suppose the next phase of that would be fitness, which is becoming a big thing now. And I suppose the will as well.
Yeah, again, we're moving sort of slightly across the skills and attitudes of some of those. And knowledge, you're right. Okay, so what does a fit rally driver look like? What does a fit rally driver eat? So I need to do a little bit of research around that, a little bit of research around fitness, and of course, a little bit of research around the mental side of things as to one of the biggest issues as we talked about before, and it's certainly something I advocate, is the biggest competitor is the one inside your mind and inside your head, not the road, not the person who's on the stage before or after you. So what do I need to do in order to quiet my mind that I don't have those little devils on my shoulder telling me that I can't do it? So how do I go about that? So what's the knowledge I need to be able to do that? So those are just typical areas. And you think we'll talk about knowledge around the technique of driving as well. So what's the physics around driving? In other words, what forces are on a tire? To give you an example of some of the areas that we went on and specialised in. So if you think of a tire and being able to get that footprint on the ground as much as possible, three forces that's working on it. So when you accelerate, when you're cornering, of course, and you're braking. So can you do all three of those at one time? Of course you can't. So
again, how do you keep that footprint on the ground? And you start to think about what you do in the car to get that contact match as much as possible and get the tire working as efficiently as possible. So that's an area of knowledge that a lot of people wouldn't think of.
Now, I guess, would you put, we're using, an aspiring driver, I suppose, in this particular section. Would you put them with, would you let them shadow somebody at this point? You know, maybe somebody that maybe is a rung or two, you know, because I always remember being, even the bits and pieces that we've done, the very first, I spent a year basically just going around with teams and just kind of seeing what goes on behind the scene. Basically to learn it from the competition side, as opposed to just watching it as a spectacle, which is how we all get into it. But, once you kind of take a step back and you're in with teams and stuff like that, would you say that was still an important part of all this? Basically just that shadowing aspect?
It'll definitely do you no harm. Again, I was quite lucky when I turned professional and before I went to my first World Championship rally. John Kennard at the time, who used to co-drive Hayden Padden, of course, in WRC. John Kennard was one of the coordinators at ProDrive at the Subaru World Rally Team. So, again, he gave me plenty of time. I lived not that far from Banbury. So I'd go and he would mentor me around the whole coordination side of things, around proper movement schedules, service schedules as a co-driver, those types of things. Yeah, huge knowledge around that. And that's not a bad area to work on. But, you think of all the soft skills that you need. And by soft skills, I mean, as a rally driver, a co-driver, the whole point as you go through your career, there's a couple of things that need to be really important. One is you need to have a good understanding of emotional intelligence. Now, EQ, shortened to, is for me, is a lot more important than IQ. Understanding how people are thinking or what they're feeling, putting yourself in their shoes when you're trying to get them to do something for you, is really important knowledge. And there's loads of stuff around emotional intelligence. That's just one, again, little part of knowledge. If you want to progress, you're going to have really good sales skills. And again, there's loads of information out on the internet. I've got loads and loads of books on selling that have accumulated. And again, for me, one of the best places to learn is in my car, apart from listening to the Absolute Rally podcast, of course.
Of course.
but my car is just the university, because I've got so many audiobooks and all the skills that I need to continue doing my job in coaching. But, if you start to think back about all the different levels of knowledge, it's a huge, huge amount of information to take on.
So taking that step from knowledge, we've established... Well, we don't feel like we're doing it justice, but we've scratched the surface of knowledge, certainly. Mm. I suppose the big thing that people come to, I guess, then is skills. Now, is skills necessarily just ability to drive a car, or is skills, could you even call it people skills as well? Is this a sweeping generalization, skills, or is it specifically ability in a car?
Yeah, again, you can't do it justice, as you rightly point out, when you're spending 5 minutes or so on each of these key topics. But that's the difference in doing a generic coaching piece like this versus having a conversation with somebody, finding out what areas that they're lacking in, getting them to work out what the priorities would be, and therefore working on those priorities to increase the knowledge, have better skills, or maybe just changing, adjusting their attitude a little bit. Once they understand where they can go to and they believe in that, and they understand that the limiting beliefs aren't there, that they can crack on to do it. And there's plenty of examples of other people who've done it. That's when you start into the personal coaching, and that's really where the benefit for a lot of people will come. The skill side of things, again, you can go off in all different areas of skill that you need. For me, just to finish off on your last point, firstly, just briefly around knowledge. One of the key areas of knowledge I think a lot of people don't take on board from a driving point of view is getting somebody into their car, number one, to set it up properly, who's got a load of experience, and number two, to show you just how fast that car can go. Once you see what it's capable of, you can readjust then your goals, you can readjust what you need to do as regards the skill practice, and that's what skill is all about, mastery. Some people will tell you it takes 10,000 hours, it can be 6 or 7 years, but that depends on where you start out in the skill scale. skill. Hard to say that one.
I was just about to say, with your accent, that was possibly a direction I thought he's going to stay away from that. No, he's not going to say. He said it. So he tried to anyway.
I know I got away with it unless you had it, but there we go. That's what it is.
You know the way it works on this. Come on.
So think of balance as being something that you need to practice, and a lot of people don't even understand that. So for me, a rally car sliding is all about feel. You get that feel from three main areas: your fingers, your bum, and the pedals. The amount of car, let's call it mass that you need to transfer, and how you feel. You know, every time you slide a car, we build up neural pathways. In really simple terms, without getting too scientific about it, if you imagine yourself in a field of long grass, and the first time you walk through that long grass, you're going to create a path. Second time you go through it, it's going to be much easier to find that path, etc., until you will automatically go there without going. That's what happens when you slide a rally car. So that weight transfer that you feel becomes something that you can do without actually thinking about it. And the more you do it, the better you get. Now, if your senses are really finely tuned, as, for example, Sebastian Loeb was a gymnast, his balance was exceptional. So therefore, when he got into a rally car, those neural pathways were easier for him to find. So therefore, unconsciously, is able to feel what a car did. You know, and some of the people that I've coached in the past, one of the first areas I'll get them to do is get on a push bike and just try and balance the push bike without moving it. So in other words, when you're stationary. And again, with practice, you can make that balance even better. Martin Rowe, again, I keep using people who I've worked with in the past who are quite happy to talk about it. Martin Rowe, who I co-drive, of course, way back, Martin used to spend his youth on a bicycle. He was fantastic on a bicycle to the point where, I remember on many rallies and recces, he'd pick up a bicycle, didn't matter what it was, what weight it was, and he could jump on it straight away and wheel it up the road, going through gears. Motorbikes the same. A quad bike, I remember in the pit lane in Silverstone, the guy just puddling about in the quad bike so he could on it. Full length of the pit lane without moving it, you know. So he just literally got on it, revved it, and off he went on the back wheels, changing gears as he went the whole length of the pit lane, Silverstone. So that is a skill, that balance, that feel. And the good news about all of this is it can be learned if you've got the right attitude and you go about finding the knowledge to do it.
Do you know, it's funny because I've got a mate of mine who used to race motorbikes, and there was that competitive element as well, and we sometimes go go-kart, and we go to a really, really, really great circuit, which is near Bala called GYG Kart, and if anyone knows it, David Higgins spends quite a lot of time there as well. It's a proper international circuit, and we go there, and because he's a bike racer, and everyone always assumes because you do rallying, you're going to be quick. And I'm not great in a kart, it has to be said. And he will basically hand me my backside on a plate until it starts raining.
Yeah.
And it starts breaking away. Uh-huh. And I'm completely and utterly in my element. And he completely and utterly crumbles because he is so used to being, obviously, on a bike, you know, road racing and stuff like that, you know, on that kind of that edge of that tyre. Yep. And he's not used to stuff breaking away, whereas stuff breaking away for us is second nature.
Well, this is the whole thing. It was always interesting. I speak about this a lot on Rally Great Britain when I'm on the radio. Traditionally, Formula One drivers, UK-based Formula One drivers, if they were able to do a rally, it was old speed rally Great Britain or the RSC rally as it was back then. You couldn't pick a more challenging rally as regards the surface changes that you get on that. So, you know, and if you think of any Formula One track or any international racetrack throughout the world, they use the same specification tarmac, and that tarmac is either dry, it's wet, or it's damp. And that's all they have to cope with. You know, you think of Rally Great Britain, you've done it a few times. On one long corner, you could have probably three or four different surface changes. David Evans did a fascinating piece in the programme for Rally Great Britain in 2016. Interviewing Ogier, and Sebastian Ogier said it took him a rally. He first came to GB with Citroën. He was fastest in the first stage, which was in the snow. First stage, much more, and he binned it. And he thought, okay, I need to change tack here a little bit. So what's really interesting about that article, he was able to pick up by looking at the road without even thinking about it unconsciously. And this is the whole luck thing with Ogier a lot of people talk about, and the same with Martin and the same with Loeb. They're very lucky. their peripheral vision, what they see unconsciously or subconsciously, is different to any other driver. That's not just on the rally, it's on the recce as well. So the colour, the contrast, what the road looks like, that old muscle memory thing, those neural pathways that we talked about, are something that they recognise without even thinking about it. So as soon as they see that, literally in an instance, they know a lot more than a lot of other people what that surface feels like, and therefore the balance, the weight transfer, what that's going to feel like in the car. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, no, I completely get it. I completely get it. I wish I had it, but I completely get it. it's one of those things. But that again, you know, everybody's always looking for what is the difference between these guys, and you know, you've just hit upon something there straight away.
So my point is, you know, that stuff, number one, it can be learned. Number two, you need to believe that it can be learned. And you can't just say, well, you know, they're brilliant. They've got it naturally. They were born with it. Of course, they were born with a better level of it. But when you break it down into, well, where does your body need to get that sensitive information in? So how do I fine tune? So instead of worrying about what I can't do, or working on assumptions of what I can't do, let's just focus on what your body naturally needs in order to work out what the car is going to do. And you'll get that via your senses, via your eyes, of course, when you look at the road, via the feel, particularly certain parts of your finger. And of course, you feel the balance and the sliding, what's happening in the seat, you know, literally driving to the seat of your pants. And of course, your pedals, you know, the feet, are great feedback. So if you start to focus more on those three areas, and your brain has only got a limited amount of processing, it can't really work with that much more than that. So the more you fill it with that good feedback that you need in order to feel what the car is doing, the less it can worry about what you can and can't do.
Okay, which brings us quite neatly onto skills.
Yeah, well, and that's a lot of that's around skills. I think, and, you know, practicing what you can. Once you get the knowledge of what you need to focus on, then you need to practice it. And the mental skills that we're talking about around that is really important that you practice those. The attitude's a big thing, really, which we need to come to really at the end of it, Tony. And attitude's all about, number one, going back to what we talk about, the limiting self-beliefs. If you think you can be a Sebastian Ogier, if you've gone down that route, or a Sebastian Loeb, and we certainly saw, again, the consistency of Loeb in Mexico. So what does that consistency look like? Can I do it? Yes, everybody can. It'll take some a little bit longer than others. Then the attitude is going to be, okay, what do I need to do? When do I need to do it? And then we go back through the cycle again, make sure the goals are set in place firmly. And then we'll start to move down the route of what do I need to sacrifice, or how much am I going to sacrifice in order to attain these goals, which is what we'll move on to next week.
I was just about to say, don't do what I normally do, which is move on to the next one. So the next week we're going to cover sacrifice. So Trev, you'll be back with us next week. You're on your jollies at the moment. So you go and put your feet up, have a glass of sangria and enjoy the sun.
I will do. It is beautiful here as well in Palma.
Oh, there you go. It's actually, we've got damp concrete here. We've just been talking about that. We've got damp concrete, and for us in the north, that's a basking sunshine. Folks, thank you all so much for the download. It is great to have you. And again, apologies last week for the super long podcast. We will try and keep them to an hour and 20 minutes normally, but it was just one of those ones that we just could not put it out as it was intended, basically, in one hit. So there you go. You know where we live. It's Absolute_Rally on Twitter, facebook.com/Absolute Rally. All the old episodes are on absoluterally.co.uk. And we'll be back same time, same place in your little podcast hole next week.